I'm honored to have been invited to give a Dewey lecture, named for the philosopher and educationist John Dewey. The remit of the lecturer is to reflect broadly and in an autobiographical spirit on philosophy in America from the perspective of a personal intellectual journey. I've enjoyed many of the previous Dewey lectures and have found it particularly interesting to learn something of the family background and early years of philosophers I've only known in professional contexts. I've therefore included some of my own backstory. My story starts in Britain, where I was born and educated and became a professional philosopher. I was a first generation college student, though not the first in my family to go to college. My parents, both born in London, were the children of immigrants. My father's father was a cobbler, and my mother's parents ran a trimming shop. My father left school when he was 13 and worked as a paperboy in order to help his family financially. In due course, he was apprenticed to a jeweler and became one himself with a small office and workshop in Hatton Garden, London's jewelry district. A kind, jovial person, he loved his work and was loved by his colleagues and customers. At one point, his secretary was Miss Anne Sullivan, which of course led to joking references to Gilbert and Sullivan. Many years later, when I was living in the States, a philosopher of my acquaintance informed someone that I was a descendant of that Gilbert. How he came to believe it, I can't say, but here I've just made the record straight. My mother went to secretarial school. She worked as a secretary before she was married and afterwards helped my father in his business when she could. Among her special skills were shorthand, something I never learned to decipher, as I marveled that she could read the arbitrary looking squiggles she had made when making notes. The third member of our family was my brother Martin. Though he was 5 years older, I was for several years effectively an only child. At the beginning of the Second World War, he had been part of an effort to save British children from the effects of the war, traveling with my aunt and her children to Canada on a dangerous sea voyage. My mother had been denied the papers necessary to accompany him and missed him greatly. But perhaps it was just as well for me, because I doubt, well, I wouldn't have been born if she had accompanied him. Because for some years before he returned, I was born. His return can't have been the easiest transition for either of us, but we made it. Having lived through two world wars and participated as he could in defending London in the second, my father was intensely interested in modern history, along with contemporary politics. I remember one time in my late teens when he and Martin were discussing politics at the dinner table. We had finished our meal and my mother was in the kitchen dealing with its aftermath. I was sitting at one end of the table listening to them talk. I wish I could remember their conversation. What I remember is my father saying at one point, "Margaret, go and help your mother in the kitchen," or words to that effect. Reluctantly, I did as he said, and most likely my mother shooed me away. She was a great supporter of my studies and barely tried to initiate me into the mysteries of domesticity. Yes, I'm grateful for the former and perhaps not so grateful for the latter. Years before the episode at the dinner table, I was sitting on my own in our family room thinking about conversation. What I thought could be expressed like this. When I contribute to a conversation, when, for instance, I say to some friends that so-and-so is a lovely person, my intention is not so much to have the other participants know what I think or to have them think what I think, as to offer a point for consideration. Everyone is, as it were, throwing points into the ring so that the group can decide what to accept and what to reject. For those who know something about my work as a professional philosopher, you might say that I haven't advanced much philosophically beyond my early teenage self. That may well be so, to some extent at least. Another thing I remember thinking when I was even younger was that I was wise. I also felt that I was somehow very old, considerably older than those around me. Those thoughts did not last, and the first, at least, the thought that I was wise has not recurred. Around the time of my thoughts about conversation, I had my first brush with academic philosophy. I was browsing among the books on the bookshelves in our living room when I came across a copy of Ayer's Language, Truth, and Logic. I assume that Martin put it there, though where he had got it from, I don't know, because he would not yet have been in college. I opened the book, curious to see what it was about. I was immensely disappointed. It was full of long, unfamiliar words. I could make nothing of it. I put it back on the shelf, never to open that copy again. I was lucky to go to South Hampstead High School for Girls, an excellent school which admitted pupils supported by government scholarships. I myself was a scholarship girl. I enjoyed most subjects and found it hard to choose three to specialise in for A-levels, as we had to do. So children in England in those days specialised in three subjects only from about 16. I knew that I did not want to do history because that's what Martin did. I chose to do Latin, Greek, and mathematics, but I was told that the school curriculum would not allow for that particular combination of subjects. I settled for Latin, Greek, and French with an eye to getting into Oxford or Cambridge to read classics, a booming subject in those days. I was interviewed at both universities. At some point in my Oxford interview at Somerville College, I expressed an interest in studying social psychology. I knew little about it, but liked the sound of it. I was told that it barely existed at Oxford and the subject was dropped. Having offers from both Oxford and Cambridge, I had to decide where to go. Martin was by then an undergraduate at Oxford, having first completed 2 years of compulsory national service in the army. His being at Oxford was an important consideration in favor of Cambridge. I'd already had a taste of being identified to third parties as Martin's sister, or being asked when I gave my full name if that's what I was. It was not something I relished. For this and other reasons, I chose Cambridge, and more specifically Girton, one of the three women's colleges. In those days, each college took either men or women, but not both. One of my classics teachers had assured me when I was making my college applications that Girton was not far from the town centre. In my opinion, formed when it was too late to make any difference, this was not the case. It was probably good for me, though, to be forced to cycle from college to town and back most days. I loved the years studying classics. It was both edifying and exciting to study altogether the history, literature, and philosophy of the periods in question. You know intimately, for instance, in the original language, what Plato was setting aside when he banned the poets and playwrights from his ideal city. What poets and what playwrights they were. I got a first in part one classics, and going on to part two meant choosing between classical history, literature, and philosophy. I went to a meeting with a distinguished professor, Professor Guthrie, who would be in charge of the philosophy branch, and he said firmly that the works in question would be studied from a philological perspective. I did not find this at all attractive and decided to move on from classics, which left me with a wide range of options. My move to post-classical philosophy was encouraged by attendance at a lecture on a topic in the history of philosophy by Jonathan Bennett. His enthusiasm for his subject was so strong, it was hard not to think of it was of the greatest importance. I signed on, joining a lively group of undergraduates, many of whom became professional philosophers in due course. At the time, someone divided us into the Bennettites and the Louisites, referencing Casimir Louis, who also taught at Cambridge at the time. We were also dubbed in the same order the amateurs and the professionals. I suppose this was because Louis's work was more technical. In addition to Bennett and Louis, one of our lecturers was John Wisdom, whose gestures, such as clutching his head while thinking aloud during his lectures, were said to resemble those of Wittgenstein, his erstwhile colleague. Undergraduate life in Cambridge was full of non-academic activities. It was a social world for the women who were outnumbered by the men by 10 to 1. Yes, 10 to 1. It was also a chance to try many extracurricular activities, which in my case included acting, co-authoring and drawing a cartoon strip for Varsity, the undergraduate newspaper, and as a volunteer, paying regular visits to patients at the psychiatric hospital just outside Cambridge, to whom I brought my version of art therapy, working with a range of patients from adolescents to the very old. This was a moving and compelling experience. I contemplated becoming a clinical psychologist and asked for an interview with Professor Zangwill, the then professor of psychology. Knowing of my first in classics, Professor Zangwill said that I should become a psychiatrist. You know, psychiatrists were sort of first in the pecking order and clinical psychologists came second. He didn't think that was appropriate for me. I didn't relish the idea of the years of further training that would entail and looked elsewhere. I was happy to get a first in part two philosophy and decided to pursue an Oxford BPhil in philosophy based at St Anne's. The BPhil, a two-year graduate degree involving examinations and a dissertation, had been initiated by Gilbert Ryle, who intended it to be a substitute for a doctorate as a way into university teaching. In due course, it did so serve for me in the United Kingdom, but it was generally understood that one might need a degree with a D in it in order to teach in the United States. That summer, I wrote a Cambridge novel. It contained disguised descriptions of some of my Cambridge friends, but the plot was pure fiction. I made no serious attempt to publish it. I did submit it for a grand literary prize, as one might buy a lottery ticket, and was not overly fazed by its failure to win. At that point, however, I put it aside. Oxford was a wonderland for budding philosophers. The philosophy faculty was huge and included a galaxy of famous names, with several of whom I was privileged to have one-on-one tutorials over an eight-week period, the length of an Oxford term, during my BPhil years. Gilbert Ryle was my primary supervisor and a kind and friendly presence. I remember writing an essay for him in the philosophy of mind, however, which was not favorable to behaviorism. He greeted this with little more than the response, "Well, you know what I think about this." Ryle was rumored to write very short letters of reference, such as, "Take this man." It was usually a man. Another supervisor was Peter Strawson, who took me for Kant. That's an ambiguous sentence, but I'll let the context disambiguate it. This was particularly interesting since I'd studied Kant with Bennett in Cambridge, and Strawson's take was very different. Strawson's letter of reference, which was reported to me at some point, said that I was one of the best of the current crop of female graduate students at Oxford. I wondered when I heard this if he thought of philosophy on the model of tennis, where female players tend to be compared only with other female players. They're not in the same league as the men. The other graduate student women at Oxford were, in any case, impressive philosophers from any point of view. I'm not sure how well, if at all, Strawson knew them. I'm thinking of Sarah Brodie, Dorothy Edgington, Rosalind Hursthaus, and Anne Jacobson, to name a few. For political philosophy, I saw Alasdair MacIntyre. Our first supervision was not auspicious. I had a terrible cold when I was writing the prescribed essay and arrived in his rooms to hear him say, scathingly, that it was pedestrian. I cycled home to my college, St. Anne's, in tears. Next time, my cold gone and my efforts increased, my essay was received favorably. My BPhil thesis was prompted by an encounter with Sartre's idea that, in his translated words, character has existence only for the other. I can't remember in what context I came across this view, embedded as it is in Being and Nothingness. In any case, it immediately resonated with me, and I wanted to think about it further from the standpoint of analytic philosophy, as opposed to Sartrean existentialism. The resulting thesis was entitled Asymmetries Between the Self-Ascription and the Other Ascription of Character Traits. I received a distinction on both the thesis and on the examinations for the BPhil in 1967. This, I believe, was relatively rare. Realizing that my thesis represented an original piece of philosophy, I approached Oxford University Press to see if they would like to publish it. I received a disconcerting response, which went roughly as follows. "She writes well," said a referee, "but no one is interested in character traits. Why don't you ask her to write a book on the mind-body problem?" Not realizing or not caring that I might be on the cusp of receiving a book contract from a leading university press after 2 years in graduate school, I didn't pursue the referee's idea. I did send an article based on one of my chapters of the Journal of Philosophy. Titled Vices and Self-Knowledge, it included in passing a suggestion as to how to render Moore's paradox unparadoxical. The journal liked the paper, but wanted me to shorten it considerably, by half, in fact. Among other things, I cut my treatment of Moore's paradox. The article was published in the journal in 1971. In due course, it made an impact on Dick Moran, who said as much when we first met. I think he said it influenced the course of his research. My first full-time teaching post was at Manchester University in the United Kingdom, where after 3 years, I was in effect tenured. I was hired to teach the history of modern philosophy and aesthetics, and that's what I did. I'd not been to that part of England before, and it lived up to its name of being colder in climate than the South, but warmer as to its people. It was also full of terrific restaurants offering a variety of cuisines at very manageable prices. In 1970, I came to the States for the first time on leave from Manchester to take up a visiting teaching position at UC Davis. I'm not sure quite how this came about. In any case, I took a leave from Manchester and went off to the States. The first important thing that happened to me professionally speaking took place before I touched down in New York, where I was to stay for a short while before heading west. On the plane, I found myself sitting next to Mark Gluberman, a young philosopher I'd met at Oxford, who happened to have with him David Lewis's book, Convention, published the year before. Mark must have expressed enthusiasm for the book, and I resolved to read it myself. I say more about Convention shortly. Back on terra firma, I spent some days in a friend's apartment in Manhattan and felt very much at home there. It was, however, a great and unpleasant shock to see a policeman carrying a gun. From New York, I flew to California. Living in Davis during the week, I maintained a room in an apartment in Berkeley, and on weekends rode there and back through gently rolling, uninhabited hills in a nice little vehicle provided by the university. I emphasize the gently rolling, uninhabited hills because last time I was there, they were very much inhabited and built upon. After attending one of my colleague Fred Berger's lectures on the philosophy of social science, I pointed out an error in an argument of Karl Popper's for the impossibility of a social science that he'd reviewed. We decided to write a joint paper on the topic, which finally appeared in print after some extraordinarily long delays. It got lost on someone's desk for about a year. Fred was wonderful to work with, and his untimely death not long after was a great shock. In 1971, I left my position in Manchester for personal reasons that drew me back to Oxford, where I had obtained a one-year research fellowship at St. Anne's. The job market was still relatively friendly to new recruits, but even in those days, it was something of a stretch to give up tenure for a temporary post, let alone a one-year temporary post. I'd chosen to pursue the question of how to demarcate the social realm. Among the reasons for this choice were a sense that though many of the philosophers I read were saying such things as language is or is not social, no one was saying what it was to be social. I had found the sociologist Max Weber's answer clear, but disappointing, while Emil Durkheim's was promising, but obscure. The eventual result of this work was a long doctoral dissertation, which, echoing Durkheim, I entitled On Social Facts. I say more about this dissertation shortly. In 1972, after my year at St Anne's was up, I was elected to a longer research fellowship at St Hilda's. I also began teaching a one-year course in the philosophy of social science at Reading University in the sociology department. That same year, I organized a small reading group of Oxford philosophers to discuss Lewis's convention. The members included Christopher Peacock and Mark Sainsbury. Lewis himself joined us for one meeting when he was in Oxford, by my invitation, which began a lifelong professional friendship. Starting with great enthusiasm, I later became critical of Lewis's account of social convention, developing a radically different account of my own. I also discovered mistakes in his use of game theory, which had been touted by Quine in the introduction or preface to Lewis's book, which Lewis generously encouraged me to publish. My admiration for Lewis's introduction of what he called common knowledge into the literature continues undimmed. It is unfortunately often represented in such a way that it seems that there can be no such thing. Obviously, well, it's only important for the kind of philosophy I do if there is such a thing. Now, Saul Kripke was due to give the prestigious John Locke lectures in 1973. I only knew of him as a modal logician and imagined his work would be inaccessible to me. I asked Chris Peacock about this, and he astutely recommended that I read Naming and Necessity. It was, of course, both accessible and profound. The day of the first Locke lecture arrived. It was to be held in a vast T-shaped room in the examination schools. I was close to the back of the central section facing the lectern. All of the rows in front of me were full. I think the whole place was full. Kripke came to the podium and began speaking. Almost immediately, he made a humorous remark, as is his wont. I burst out laughing, only to notice the silence around me. Then, slowly, a growing tide of laughs followed mine, and finally the room was filled with laughter. Not long after, the Oxford rumour mill had it that Saul and I were engaged. We were not, but 3 years later, we married. 6 weeks after that, courtesy of the United States Immigration Services, I entered this country as a resident alien without any academic appointment. Saul was teaching at Rockefeller University in New York at the time, but almost immediately after we'd settled in an apartment by the East River, right by the university, it decided to close its philosophy department for financial reasons. So now Saul Kripke, Donald Davidson, Harry Frankfurt, and Joel Feinberg, all absolutely at the top of their game, needed to find new philosophical homes. This news traveled fast, in part perhaps because of a New York Times article on the subject. Saul received multiple offers, each one from an extremely distinguished university. So we were faced with a decision of a kind that neither of us was well fitted to make. Suffice it to say, in the end, that we took the shortest route out of town to Princeton. I was closing in on my doctorate. Excuse me, sorry, my text is in front of me here and it's moved. I was closing in on my doctorate and was to have my viva in Oxford with R.M. Hare and Ted Hondrich as my examiners. The viva turned out to be something historic insofar as it took place in Hare's hospital room. Hare was sitting up in bed, his face covered in red spots, presumably not contagious. It was very generous of him to have agreed to do such a thing. And I did get the doctorate. The thesis argued, in some detail, that one should think of sociality as coming in degrees. As far as that goes, I'm inclined to agree, as with the judgments I offered on which of the phenomena I describe as more social than which other. I officially received the doctorate in 1978. I sent my manuscript to the publisher Routledge and Kegan Paul, now Routledge, and in due course signed a contract for a less thesis-like version of the dissertation. In other words, I was not charged with changing the substance in any way. The manuscript was to be delivered within a year. Looking for an academic base in Princeton, where I was now living, I was lucky enough to be accepted as a member of the School of Historical Studies in the Institute for Advanced Study for the year 1978-9, courtesy of the only philosopher among the permanent members, Morton White. Contrary to what many assume, the Institute is completely independent of Princeton University. Nobody seems to know that. I stayed on at the Institute for a second year, this time as a visitor in the same school. In year one, I had an office near Morton's in Ford Hall, the main Institute building. And twice a day was lured downstairs to the large lounge where refreshments were served. The only other visiting philosopher was Dudley Shapir, of whom I saw relatively little. And I tended to spend my tea, coffee, and meal times with historians, social scientists, and occasionally mathematicians and physicists. Among others, I made the acquaintance of the Fields Medalist mathematician John Milner. Having ascertained that each of us was working on a book, he asked me for whom I was writing mine. I thought a bit and said I was writing it for myself. I wanted better to understand the matter at hand. He said that went for him as well. It turned out that my search for better understanding while at the Institute led me in a new direction, so that in effect, I began to write a new book. It's hard to pinpoint the moment this happened. I remember feeling quite lonely one day when I'm working in the almost empty Institute library and trying to understand what prompted this feeling, what was missing. I had a strong sense that the game theoretical picture of one person's relation to another, exemplified by the participants in Lewisian conventions, for instance, lacked something important. It was too distant, too detached. When I came up with the idea of joint commitment, I was terrifically excited. I believed it could be developed and applied so widely, it would provide me with the work of a lifetime. And that turned out to be so. After leaving the Institute, and when I wasn't working elsewhere, I was hosted as a non-stipendiary visiting fellow by the Princeton Philosophy Department, then regarded as the premier philosophy department in the country. I attended and actively participated in departmental colloquia and many of Saul's and others' graduate seminars. Margaret Wilson, the only woman on the faculty, became a personal friend. In order to bring my book to completion, I asked Gil Harman to help me in a way I thought would cause him minimal inconvenience. I would tell him when to expect a full draft of a particular chapter. And if it did not come into his mailbox on time, and these were days when we'd give a hard copy, he was to prompt me. He was in no way expected to read what I wrote. I just wanted to be accountable to someone outside my household for getting the work done. And I know there are some graduate students watching this, and I think you know what I mean. In the event, Gil, who was a speed reader, read the first chapter I gave him, and returning to me, he wrote on it, "This is a marvelous chapter." His encouragement was very precious to me. It took me a long time to put together what might have been called On Social Facts 2, and the press took a long time to publish it, something of a horror story I shall not go into here. That had nothing to do with the fact that it differed significantly in content from On Social Facts 1. It was really a different book. Once it was done, the press's referee said it was, quote, genuinely original, and urged them to publish it. The unnumbered On Social Facts came out in late 1988. I guess it's sort of, I don't know, it's known as 1989, but that was when it came out. My rather spotty academic career had become a bit less spotty in 1983 after I applied for a tenured associate professor at the University of Connecticut Storrs, intended for someone specializing in the philosophy of social science. It seemed a long way from Princeton, but I was encouraged to think it was doable. My job talk at UConn was memorable in the following way. My avowed objective was an analysis of the everyday concept of a social convention, in which I would take issue with Lewis's account of that. In the discussion period, a sharp-faced member of the audience asked me, "What makes you think there is such a thing as conceptual analysis?" After a moment, I replied, "Well, that's what I'm doing in this paper." It turned out that my interlocutor was also a candidate for the job. Can you believe that? Though she was not in the relevant field. As a result of whatever behind-the-scenes deliberation, each of us was offered a half-time associate professorship without tenure, since there was no such thing as half-time tenure to be had. I took the job, as did Ruth Millikan, and already twinned as we now were, we became friends as well as colleagues. We continued to spar philosophically at least once while swimming together in a local pond. Some years later, I gave a talk at the University of Michigan. It was Walking Together, which after publication became my most cited paper. Chatting with a Michigan faculty member, I revealed that neither Ruth nor I had tenure. "Ruth Millikan doesn't have tenure," he exclaimed, leaving me feeling a little rough. This conversation was, I believe, consequential for both Ruth and myself. Suffice it to say that in 1996, 13 years after we were hired as non-tenured half-timers, UConn offered Ruth a full-time tenured professorship with a half-time teaching load. And thanks to Ruth's insistence, it offered me a full-time tenured professorship also. I was to have a regular teaching load with the proviso that if I wished, I could take an unpaid semester's leave each year. So slightly different arrangements, but still, I had a full-time teaching, tenured teaching appointment. I took the offer and never took an unpaid leave. The UConn department was remarkable for the collegiality of its citizens and their enthusiasm for philosophy as a collaborative process. A highlight of the week was the Brown Bag, instituted by Joel Kupperman, at which faculty and less often graduate students would give 20-minute talks on their current research, or indeed on any current point that took their fancy, and everyone else would jump in for the rest of the hour. Many of my publications while I was there started as a Brown Bag talk that benefited from the comments of many acute minds with philosophical specialties other than my own. In the end, I was at UConn for 23 years until I moved to UC Irvine in California. By then, my marriage had ended and I was otherwise free to move even further from my starting point. On my way to my job talk at UC Irvine in 2006, I parked my car in a blizzard at Hartford Airport, knowing it would take a while to dig it out on my return. I arrived in California in brilliant sunshine at a hotel with an inviting swimming pool. In due course, I was offered the Abraham I. Meldon Chair in Moral Philosophy, broadly construed. The meteorological and professional temptations were obvious, and I took what was, in personal terms, an enormous step. I've now been at UCI for 14 years, which is actually hard to believe. While at UConn, I had published around 70 articles, 3 books of my papers, and 2 monographs on social facts, 1989, A Theory of Political Obligation, Membership, Commitment, and the Bonds of Society, 2006. At UCI, I've published another 30 or so articles, two more books of my papers, with one more pending, and a third monograph, Rights and Demands, a Foundational Inquiry, and thanks to Michael for just mentioning them in his introduction. The monographs constitute, in effect, a trilogy in which I explore expansively from different angles the theory that joint commitment plays a major role in our lives, in addition to being a bulwark against loneliness. That exploration has been fruitful, and I hope that when I have to stop, others, whether philosophers or, as is now happening, theorists and experimentalists in other fields, such as Michael Thomas Sello, the developmental psychologist and primatologist, I hope that they will continue to find it so. As a philosopher, I've largely followed my own path, finding topics that intrigued me, whether or not they had yet intrigued anyone else. Witness my BPhil thesis and actually the material on social phenomena, and looking for answers that would satisfy me in the first instance. But most of my philosophizing has been done as part of a collective enterprise, whether as a student, a teacher, a conference or colloquium participant, or the author or object of a peer review. Among the highlights of my life in philosophy have been the annual APA meetings, where one can meet and fraternize with philosophers from throughout the United States and beyond. The staff and members of the APA who organize these meetings, largely behind the scenes, put a great deal of work into them, work which may not always be sufficiently appreciated by those who both enjoy and benefit from them. So here is a shout out to them. On Social Facts was, I believe, the subject of the first Author Meets Critics session at the Eastern APA. Apart from such formal sessions, there have been the books displays, where one runs into people one knows as a matter of chance, chats to publishers, and generally mingles with other philosophers. And what used to be called the smokers, held in enormous rooms in which individual departments had their own tables, and one could look at those tables for people one knew or wanted to meet. Then there were all the chance encounters around the hotel, the impromptu lunches and dinners, and quite a bit of walking around cities together. As time has gone by, after finding I knew of almost everyone I ran into, which was really great, I've begun to find I know fewer people, which is as it should be as younger generations move up the ranks. This is a reminder that in doing and writing philosophy, one is not only satisfying one's own curiosities, but contributing to a collective enterprise that will endure beyond the confines of one's own short life, and hopefully as long as humans inhabit the earth. Thank you.